Thank you so much. It's an honor to be with you and to participate in this section. And I look forward to the course of meetings at the ETS this year. I want to begin with a quotation that sets the stage for why I would entitle a paper, Secularization and Its Discontents. The writer is Mark Lila of Columbia University. The opening paragraph from his book published last year entitled The Stillborn God. The twilight of the idols has been postponed. For over two centuries, from the American and French revolutions to the collapse of Soviet communism, political life in the West revolved around eminently political questions. We argued about war and revolution, class and social justice, race and national identity. Today we have progressed to the point where we are again fighting the battles of the 16th century. Over revelation and reason, dogmatic purity and toleration, inspiration and consent, divine duty and common decency, we are disturbed and confused. We find it incomprehensible that the theological ideas still inflame the minds of men, stirring up messianic passions that leave societies in ruin. We assumed that this was no longer possible, that human beings had learned to separate religious questions from political ones, that fanaticism was dead. We were wrong. Now, those three words, we were wrong, are three dramatically uncommon words in academic literature, especially in the social sciences, where we may have misinterpreted the data, or we may have to look forward to observing future trends. Are more common responses than we were wrong. The secularization theory that has been dominant in terms of the mind of the West, in terms of the intellectual elites, and especially those who are involved in the social sciences, is a theory that is in crisis. It is in crisis and now is demonstrating its own discontents because it has been refuted by history. The unfolding of the last century, in particular the last half century, has refuted the secularization theory to the point that there is now no general secularization theory possible, and instead we are looking at a complete reformulation of the theory. Earlier this year, I published a book entitled Atheism Remix, A Look at the New Atheism. In the course of the research for that volume, I reacquainted myself with the literature on secularization. And as I was conducting that research, it struck me that a second book might be well advised, and that is on how evangelicals should understand the consternation among the sociologists and the intellectual elites in the collapse of secularization theory. We were wrong, says Mark Lila. The question is, wrong about what, actually? The focus of this is the classic form of secularization theory. The intellectual elites in the West have been absolutely certain as a matter of doctrinal presumption that religious faith and religious belief would wane, that religious institutions would weaken as modernity was completed as a project. It has not happened. We need a much clearer look at what secularization theory had foretold and prophesied, what it had predicted, and what has actually happened. In speaking of secularization theory, we're speaking, of course, of those who founded the modern discipline and cognitive area of knowledge of sociology, but we're speaking of persons who in our own lifetimes have been writing, persons such as Brian Wilson and Grace Davey, Callum Brown, and, of course, Peter Berger. Now, when you start speaking of exactly what is going on here, you realize that there is some sense in which some are responding to this almost in terms of hyperbole. It is as if not only a theory is in crisis, but an entire worldview. And as we shall see, that is basically what is at stake. In one sense, the new atheism itself is something of the end game of secularism. In order to understand this, we have to understand why secularism and secularization theory are now so much in question. Let me just, as a matter of definitional precision, say that when we are talking about secularism, I would speak of it as the literature predominantly would speak of it as an ideology. Not just as a phenomenological observation, but as an ideology, as a statement of what those who would present a secularist worldview would hope would become an ideology shared by others. secularization is intended to be, in terms of its theoretical expression, an explanation for phenomena. It is, as Peter Berger will argue, in its essence, value neutral. There are those who observe the same data and observe the same reality would think that this development is a positive development, that it would be a good thing that religion would lose its influence, that religious institutions would be weakened. And there are those who, looking at the same data, would agree on the phenomena, but would argue that this is a deleterious development. Early sociological analysis emerged from the attempt to explain human social behavior on autonomous terms, that is, apart from what had been the explanation of the Christian worldview. It was thought and assumed that as modernity works its way through civilization, as human beings learn to harness the energies of nature, dam rivers, eventually split the atom, as human beings would increase their cognitive reach and would come to understand themselves internally and externally as disciplines as disparate as nuclear physics and psychology and psychiatry would change the gestalt of the time and the worldview of modern people, there would be less and less need for God as a causal explanatory factor in the intellectual framework of civilization. As the secularization theorists saw the future, life would become increasingly rationalized. It would become increasingly differentiated. It would be, as Emile Durkheim said and argued most clearly, disenchanted. More and more of life would be experienced in a secular space, as secular minds would embrace a secular understanding of a reality that was stripped of the supernatural. These references would no longer be meaningful. They may be a part of the past. They may be recited in poetry. They may become a part of the ancestral memory of a civilization, but they would no longer have any binding authority. Inevitably, God would recede from human consciousness. Max Weber and Emile Durkheim, of course, spoke of this. Weber argued for disenchantment as the basic reality. Eventually, modernity would lead to society's disenchantment with the world. Now, his basic divide here is between a world of enchantment, which is basically a shorthand for speaking about a world that is framed by a supernatural consciousness, and then a world of disenchantment in which that consciousness has been stripped away. God would no longer be a necessary and meaningful referent. And in this new disenchanted or secular world, human beings would come of age intellectually. Durkheim predicted the same, as did, of course, Auguste Comte. More of him later. Modernity was understood as a humanity come of age, and religious faith and belief in God were seen as recidivist, backward, and as limiting beliefs that would inevitably recede. The confidence of the intellectual elites and the early sociologists was that human beings would become embarrassed of the supernatural. This disenchantment would be not only in terms of the observation of the larger world, but would be, of course, an interior experience, as the experience of the modern self, the self shaped by modernity, would become a self embarrassed by the presumption of the supernatural. Lying behind the secularization theory were two great assumptions. First, the theory assumes that theism is basically an inherited belief that is necessary to provide meaning, coherence, and comfort. Little footnote here, this is where many of the new atheists are really picking up the same kind of functional argument. Daniel Dennett, in particular, Tufts University, argues as an evolutionist that there must have been an evolutionary function to religious faith. It must have been an absolutely necessary part of what was produced through the process of natural selection. Evidently, nature selected those who had theistic beliefs at some point because they turned out to be very predominant and easily passed down to the young. He says, however, of course, whatever that function was, we've since outgrown it, and now it's a dysfunctional function. But nonetheless, as an evolutionist, he has to admit that somehow it got here. If natural selection means anything, it meant that this won out over the non-supernatural genes. It's a functional understanding. Theism, according to this worldview, is simply something that was necessary. If you are not an evolutionist basing this upon the replication of genes, then you understand it socially and psychologically in terms of internal needs, both in terms of the individual and of the individual in community with others. In other words, secularization theory began with and is essentially reduced to a functional understanding of religion. So as religion's function is no longer needed, believe the theorists, people will find other sources of comfort and meaning in life. Therefore, belief in God would inevitably recede. It would recede first in terms of its binding authority. As the causal explanation provided by theism was no longer necessary, the binding authority of religion would begin to break apart. The symbolism would retain its meaning, its poetry, its hold upon the emotions, but by and large, the binding authority is what would be left behind. And we must note that several of these theorists desperately wanted the binding authority of theism and the supernatural to be stripped away from Western civilization. Secondly, secularization theory assumes that the forms of religious belief are supported by the acknowledgement of its social functions. In other words, the secularization theorists actually believed that, and many of them wrote that, at some point the high priests of the supernatural would realize this isn't working anymore. In other words, accepting a functional understanding, they would simply find something else that works. The adherents of secularization theory believed that religious forms would remain for some time after true belief was gone, at least so long as people found them aesthetically attractive, but that they would eventually disappear. The elaborated version of theory came down to this: the supernatural would no longer be cognitively possible. There would emerge an awkwardness, a cognitive awkwardness, that would make it more difficult. This would show up, of course, first in the educated elites, where God as a causal explanation would simply disappear. So the conversation among those of the cognoscendi would then become a secularized conversation. Eventually, the entire world of art and the symbolic would also be transformed, but they understood that this would take a much longer period of time. They saw it working out in this way. First, it would become plausible or thinkable not to believe in God. Then, socially speaking, it would become inevitable that one would not believe in God at all. Secularization theorists believed that education, of course, would play a very large role in this, overcoming what Nietzsche would call the intellectual infancy of humanity. But as humanity has now come of age, belief in God is no longer necessary. Freud put it this way, quote, "The more the fruits of knowledge become accessible to men, the more widespread is the decline of religious belief," end quote. Ultimately, then, modernity would produce a fully secularized world. On a global scale, it would begin in the West, where technology, scientific advance, and democratic theory had most quickly taken shape and taken hold of the consciousness. But eventually, these ideas would spread around the world, and secularization would be a global phenomenon. Footnote here for further research. It's interesting that secularization theory emerges almost entirely in worlds shaped by the Judeo-Christian heritage, by Christianity in particular. You really do not find Shinto secularists. It's just not really there. And also, in terms of a longitudinal analysis and a cross-cultural analysis, it doesn't make sense in most places. Try talking secularism to a Buddhist who, in its classic shape, his classic shape would not be a theist. And you can understand why. This fits basically in the West, but those who came up with the theory were Westerners who were intoxicated with a Western variant of modernity. A fully secularized world would appear as human beings came of age. Indeed, it was considered that this process would be inexorable. There would be the emergence of a worldwide global secular culture led by new institutions such as the United Nations and marked by the rejection of both the social functions and eventually the symbolic nature of theistic belief. John Somerville, a major figure in secularization theory in terms of the British experience, suggested that secularization would follow this predictable pattern. First would come the secularization of space. This goes back to the 16th century, of course, in the Reformation, where you had Henry VIII taking possession of the monasteries. Space that had been sacred was transformed into the secular. He did this property by property and palace by palace. Eventually it took place within the municipal environs of London. The secularization of space was a very important part of all of this. What had been considered almost uniformly sacred space eventuated in the 16th century in London and in much of England, was sacred space reduced to a little patch of land with a parish church upon it. The rest of it understood as being thoroughly secular. Second, Somerville predicted that the secularization of time would come, and with the secularization of time, the secularization of what might be considered leisure. And this certainly did happen. It happened relatively early in the modern experience in the West, where time became secularized, and there was no longer the sense that human beings were under the constant, all-seeing eye of God at every moment. The stewardship of time became reconceptualized by the height of modernity in the 20th century, time management. replaced what had been known as anything like the discipline of the hours and praying the hours and medieval piety, a complete change. And the secularization of leisure also came down to the fact that human beings now saw private space in time. They carved out modernity in terms of even its early expressions, offered privacy and a private sphere for personal enjoyment in time as well as in place. Third would come the secularization of language, and this certainly happened in terms of much of the Western experience as the kind of language we would hear when, for instance, someone responds to an individual who has sneezed, it is no longer considered a prayer. The language has been thoroughly secularized, even when there's much reference to God. There is also, fourth, then, the secularization of technology and work. It's no longer seen as a matter of even what Max Weber would point out in early Calvinism as a matter of divine vocation, what others would see in the Lutheran tradition. It is now a job. It is now a career. No longer would individuals consider their vocation as being done to the glory of God, rather, the arguments used for particular vocations would be social utility, personal fulfillment, income, and the rest. Then would follow the secularization of art. The symbolic would follow the substantial, and thus aesthetics would become secularized. After this, the secularization of power. The early theorists argued that this would be last in the continuum, in the latter stages, because power is the most difficult causal reality to de-supernaturalize. Ponder that for a few moments. The secularization of personhood and association would eventually take place, and finally, the secularization of scholarship and science until humanity's passage from infancy and adolescence into adulthood was complete. Somerville went on to speak of six aspects of secularization. First, it would take place at the macro social institutional level. This is known as differentiation. Very, very important for us to realize that this is the one part of the theory that basically does hold everywhere. While the main shape of the theory and its main causal argument has been falling apart, the phenomenological observation of differentiation has been proved to be almost universally true. It comes down to this, just as a quick perhaps an easy comparison. If you were to go to a medieval village, the priest would be the expert in virtually every field. There would be no differentiation of professions. Their expertise would be located within the sacral sphere. Now, if you go to the modern American city, no one thinks if he or she is sick first to go to the pastor to ask for medical advice. The church no longer is the repository of financial and technological advice. This has been differentiation. There's been a redistribution of cognitive responsibilities and of tasks throughout the society. And another footnote here, the reality is that that doesn't lead to the denial of the supernatural. It turns out that modern human beings have been quite adept at accepting differentiation without becoming secularists. To make medicine transformed to a modern discipline with germ theory and anesthesia and antibiotics and all that, it turns out that believers in the supernatural will avail themselves of those things too without giving up the supernatural. This process has become a reality. Indeed, the fragmentation of knowledge and the specialization of expertise are now just taken for granted, even within the church. Whereas the church once defined reality across an entire range of earthly and intellectual fields, it does so now no longer, and most Christians accept differentiation as just a matter of precision and cognitive clarity. We live in a time in which it is plausible to us to think that people would not ask the pastor about vocational issues, intellectual questions that are related to, for instance, technical issues or economics, legal issues, and all the rest. The church used to be at the center of all of these questions. But differentiation now means that you go to a lawyer for legal advice and to a psychotherapist for counseling. In terms of the secular mind, that just makes sense. People now go to any number of experts who are completely freed from the church and from accountability to theistic belief. This is perhaps the most massive shift brought about by what we would call secularization. Second, secularization affects individual institutions. Think of all the universities and hospitals once established explicitly as Christian, not just in terms of established within the Christian tradition, but Christian in terms of being established by believing Christians who believe that their believing Christianity made a difference in the way that they would, for instance, offer medical care or education. The most significant dimension of this institutional secularization is, of course, the secularization of the academy. The secularization of colleges and universities has shaped the minds and worldviews of millions. Third, there would be the secularization of such activities as education and welfare. These things literally institutionally secularized, where, for instance, primary education, the education of younger children, be taken away from the church in terms of the development of the public school project. And, of course, social welfare would also be bureaucratized in terms of the secular state. Fourth, mentalities and worldviews, Somerville argued, would be secularized. So the basic gestalt, the basic cognitive shape and pattern of thinking would be thoroughly secularized. Of course, those who were pushing such things as the public school project, such as John Dewey, argued that this is exactly what should happen. In his book, A Common Faith, he argued that what must replace the supernatural and thus limiting worldviews of children must be this common faith, which would produce a new generation of citizens imbued with a secular faith. Fifth, Somerville argued that entire peoples would be secularized in terms of belief and identity. They would, as is seen in much of Western Europe today, desperately strive to separate themselves from their Christian heritage. It would become a matter of embarrassment. At some point, it would become plausible not to believe in the supernatural. At some later point, it would become an embarrassment to accept that one's forefathers and foremothers actually had. Finally, Somerville even talks about the secularization, of course, of religion, which is the attempt to accommodate theology to a secularized world. Sociologists, and this is where evangelicals should pay a lot of attention, sociologists speak about what they call adaptation theories, or adaptation as a process whereby churches, for instance, would attempt to respond to a secularized world in a way that would give them credence and allow them to have some future influence. There were, of course, some scholars who did not go along. By 1986, Jeffrey Haddon would say that secularization was more a doctrine than a theory. Looking at the actual phenomena, he suggested that secularization theory just didn't hold. It had to have been taken on faith. He basically, much like in The Wizard of Oz, pulled the curtain back to reveal that the people who were still pushing secularization theory were living in a world that was thoroughly unsecularized. The United States of America, for instance, is the counterintuitive example, which becomes, by its exceptionalism, the great problem for secularization theory. Because at the core of secularization theory is the assumption that modernity produces inexorably a secularized world. The problem is that America is, by any sociological definition, the most hypermodern nation. And it is also pervasively religious. However you want to define that, let's just say that sociologists who have been pushing secularization theory have no way to handle the fact that 95% of Americans claim to believe in God. Now, notice what hasn't happened here. This is not judging the actual supernatural content to this assessment. This isn't testing their theism. It's suggesting that, at the very least, they're not embarrassed to say they believe in God. To the contrary, they appear to be embarrassed to admit that they might not. It turns out that not only has the aesthetic world not been revolutionized in terms of this secular way in which it would be absolutely implausible to, for instance, make reference to theism or to the supernatural or to biblical imagery or all the rest, it turns out that parents turn out to be resistantly non-secularizers when it turns to their own children. It turns out that whatever Daniel Dennett and others want to suggest was a function in evolution is a deeply embedded meme, as Richard Dawkins is now having to accept. Instead of the spread of a global phenomenon of secularization, there appears to be a reassertion of religious belief all over the world. This is why, by the way, you had this enormous funding of the Fundamentalism Project at the University of Chicago several years ago. And if you look at that project, done, of course, mostly by historians, but there are sociologists involved, these are the people who've been arguing that a project like this shouldn't be necessary, which must have been interesting substance for a grant proposal. They basically went and got millions of dollars to study something that they themselves have predicted couldn't happen, which is the resurgence of what they would call fundamentalism around the world. Now, what happened? How is it that this has come to pass? Why do we now speak of secularization not only as a theory, but as a theory in crisis? And why do some now speak of it as not only a theory, but a doctrine that has been refuted by experience, and others to speak of it as a myth? Peter Berger, of course, who was one of the initial framers of the entire idea of secularization theory, has been very helpful in coming back to acknowledge that the theory must be recalibrated. At the same time, however, we must recognize that there is still something to it, even in its classical form. Secularization theory may have been falsified in terms of its major claims, but there are still two senses in which it was exactly right. The first sense in which secularization theory appears to have been exactly right is limited to geography. Western Europe did follow the theory almost perfectly. Rates of church going in Germany, Sweden, the Netherlands, Spain, and France hover right around 1 to 5% of the population. In many surveys, fewer than 10% of the peoples in these nations claim even to believe in God. The second exception to the failure of secularization theory, which is to say the second way in which it actually turned out to work as a theory, is among the world's cultural and intellectual elites, even within the United States of America. Peter Berger has put it most wonderfully in his quip. You may know that he was involved in this massive study done back in the 1980s. Across as a longitudinal study of world civilizations and cultures, in which sociologists tried to rank nations from the least religious to the most religious, and just by standard sociological definitions of religiosity. It turned out that the least religious country was Sweden, and the most religious country was India. Then, speaking of the United States, he said, "The United States is a nation of Indians overruled by an elite of Swedes." As Peter Berger explained, the secularized global intelligentsia is in all nations almost thoroughly secularized, but it is, by definition, in all nations always a tiny minority of the population. He says, quote, "but a very influential one." The significance of these two exceptions is that Western Europe and the world's cultural elites play an inordinate role in influencing the larger culture. Thus, the secularization of Europe and of America's elites has created a new social condition for belief. We'll return to that. Now, basically, at this point, what we have is a theory that is definitely in crisis, but it's also requiring a change in the way even the exceptions have been explained. For instance, for about 50 years, sociologists have been speaking about American exceptionalism. But as most sociologists are now beginning to recognize, it isn't American exceptionalism, it's Western European exceptionalism. It's just that the theory emerged, especially from French and German-speaking scholars who assumed that France and Germany were the center of the universe, and thus that anything that is counter to their example must be the exception. And it turns out that Western Europe is indeed the exception. Now, looking, for instance, at secularization, the definitions are constantly in flux as scholars are attempting to conform the theory to a reality. Callum Brown, for instance, defines secularization this way. He says, "Secularization represents a number of different things to scholars. First, it is a theory which, broadly speaking, defines the decline in the social significance of religion as a long-term and inevitable historical process with short-term accelerants." Do you love this? Short-term accelerants. "Such as the Reformation, the Enlightenment, industrialization, and urbanization, and also short-term retardants, generally referred to," this is his word, "as revivals." "In general terms, this theory of secularization is regarded by some scholars as now being in tatters, intellectually and above all empirically. The notion that the decline of religion has been an inevitable accompaniment of modernization is now enjoying diminishing support amongst," he says, "British social historians of religion." Secondly, he said, "secularization is, as Jeff Cox," he quotes here, "has called it, a master narrative." And this is where it gets really, really interesting, because among the elites and in so many other disciplines, it has become a master narrative. Now, Jeffrey Haddon would call it a doctrine, but it really helps us, I think, to understand that many people looking at the world would have to adopt a narrative in which they're going to explain what is taking place and what they believe will take place and what they hope will take place. And Jeff Cox here, and of course, Callum Brown quoting him, mentions this idea of a master narrative is very, very important. As a history, says Callum Brown, it is a narrative predominantly written of the period since the 18th century and centered in the historiography between 1780 and 1914. Now, if we could follow another paper at another time here, that is the period of greatest intellectual foment in terms especially of British intellectual life. This is where you are brought from what would be a predominantly Christian culture through the crisis of the Victorian loss of faith into Great Britain in a very secularized 20th century. Now, another little point to note here is that even as the theory emerged largely in continental Europe, in France and in Germany, people like Max Weber and Durkheim, it really was accelerated and expanded, worked out through the work of British sociologists, and especially in the English-speaking world. Thus, the phenomena being observed begins to shift from Europe, where it did follow the theory by and large, especially in Central Europe, not in Eastern Europe, not even in Southern Europe, but Northern and Central and Western Europe in particular. But the data then turns especially to Britain, and later, of course, to the United States. Steve Brown, another theorist of secularization, takes up where Callum Brown left off in going back to the Reformation and suggesting that it was individuation that took place there and the rise of the individual, the cognitive shape to faith that emerged with the idea of justification by faith alone, the rise of the nation state in a new political order with an ethic of toleration, and all of this basically led to a secularization of Christianity in terms of what preceded what would take place in the culture. You have theorists who are doing their very best to come up with an explanation of what the theory meant, why it failed, and what it might now mean. Very quickly, I want to look at three figures, David Martin, Peter Berger, and Charles Taylor. David Martin teaches at the London School of Economics. In 1978, he wrote his major work entitled A General Theory of Secularization. Back in 1965, he'd offered a critique of secularization theory, which even in the mid-1960s, he said, was, quote, a hodgepodge of ideas, some of them contradictory. It's kind of like the little boy who sees the emperor with no clothes. Here you have a young graduate student in Great Britain who says, you can't believe this. You can't keep on saying this because it just isn't true. It's not empirically working out. He says it was clear that even at this point, it was at least in part an ideological projection on history. And that was said in 1965. By 1978, 13 years later, he publishes his magnum opus, and in his General Theory of Secularization, he comes out and says that the basic reality behind secularization theory is the confidence that churches and sects would become less powerful and that religious beliefs would be less easily accepted. Now again, taking that as a minimal definition, but a very clear and perhaps helpful definition of secularization, this has and hasn't happened. If we're talking about differentiation, which is Martin's basic concern, it has happened. Again, we have lawyers and doctors rather than priests handling matters of medicine and law predominantly. But this hasn't led to the fact that religious beliefs have been surrendered. It is true that religious beliefs are less easily accepted. In other words, something has happened in the culture. The basic conditions of belief have changed, but it has not led to a surrender of the supernatural. David Martin pointed to the period, much like what we saw with Stephen Bruce and Callum Brown, to 1870 to 1910, suggesting that there occurred a massive intellectual shift, quote, the effect of which is to lead contemporary intellectuals to envisage secularization as due to the implausibility of beliefs. Now, this is very interesting because what you have with the reconsideration of secularization theory are some of the very people who had come from a discipline that argued that religion and religious faith are basically merely functional, to arguing that these people actually believe something. And it turns out that the beliefs are actually important. When we get last to Charles Taylor, I think that's his greatest achievement, is to say we ought to listen to what people say. We ought to listen to what they believe, what they sing. They actually believe this. This is not merely a function of their lives. It is the belief that precedes the function. David Martin wanted to go back to the ideological roots of secularization theory, pointing out that sociology itself, I'm quoting him here, emerged as part of the process of secularization because it represented the autonomous study of man and society. In other words, you can't have sociology without some secularist assumptions, because that was the very origin of the discipline. Now, later, someone like Jeffrey Haddon will come along and point out that Auguste Comte, the founder of the modern discipline of sociology, believed that human beings were in their history represented by three phases. The third phase, which was hypermodernity, was the positivist stage. And you remember he even founded a church of positivism, an atheistic, non-theistic church. He believed there would be some functional need for something like a church, but it could be a thoroughly secularized church. As David Martin explains, the circumstances of the emergence of secularization theory, quote, meant that it gave an absolutely central place to the problem of secularization and encased the problem in an ideological frame in part derived from the philosophy of history. Very Hegelian here. Again, you can work this out and understand they saw this as inevitable. It just didn't happen. He said, so secularization was made part of a powerful social and historical narrative of what once had been and now was coming to be. It just didn't happen that way. It was encased very much in an ideology, as David Martin has indicated. It's just an ideology that did not adequately explain human behavior, human reality, and the beliefs of human beings. He spoke of the great narrative of Western culture as among the intellectual elites being tied to secularization, even as, on the other hand, you had the refutation of the theory right before their eyes. He points out that many of the same people in the same conversation would insist that secularization is happening and then bemoan the emergence of what they would call fundamentalisms in various parts of the world, even where modernity was breaking out, especially places like the Pacific Rim and South America and Central America and other places. It turned out that the arrival of modernity with all the trappings of modernity did not lead to a surrender of the supernatural. Instead, David Martin says, there are two great refutations to secularization theory. All you have to say are the words evangelical Christianity and Pentecostalism. And this explains David Martin's own research. He says, now, if you want to look at Western Europe, then there you see classical modernity. You see it work out. You see the elite secularized. But even there, he says, of course, there are historical reasons for this. The French Revolution, the First World War, and then, of course, the pivotal year of 1968 in terms of especially French experience. David Martin says, the reason why the United States is so different is because the United States is the fulfillment of Britain. He suggests that the American Revolution, for instance, is the logical completion of the unfinished British Revolution. He suggests that the shape of religion in America is the working out of what was implied in the Elizabethan settlement in England, but never loosed. He points out that in America, the differentiation that is central to secularization didn't undermine supernatural belief because Americans are easily differentiated. It's just a part of the American mind. And it turns out that modernity requires differentiation, but that does not lead to secularization. The second figure is Peter Berger, the most well-known among us, of course, teaching at Boston University for so many years. He was one of the major theorists of secularization, and here just to summarize, he believed it in the classical form. In his early writings, he wrote very, very clearly of the process of secularization and how it would happen, even in the United States, perhaps later than in Western Europe, but certainly over time. As early as the 1980s, he was beginning to reconsider this. In 1999, in his book, The Desecularization of the World, that's very interesting, he edited a book with The Desecularization of the World as its title. He said, the assumption that we live in a secularized world is false. The world today, with some exceptions, is as furiously religious as it ever was. This means that the whole body of thought and work by historians and social scientists loosely labeled secularization theory is essentially mistaken. Mark Leland simply said, we were wrong. Peter Berger comes back to say this was essentially mistaken, and of course, it certainly was. Peter Berger, in his work in 1992, A Far Glory, would say it has been for a long time a widely accepted view that the modern age brought about a steep decline of religion, both on the public scene and in the minds of individuals. To say that this view has been widely accepted may even be an understatement. In some quarters, as for example, among people with higher education, it has attained the status of a taken-for-granted truth about which it would be silly to argue. He suggests, nonetheless, it simply isn't true. It didn't happen. Berger and others have tried to explain why it didn't happen. And just to summarize here, Peter Berger says it didn't happen because it turns out that there is more to religion than a function. That the religious character of a people may actually come down to the fact that they hold beliefs that they believe to be true. Berger suggests that the real issue in secularization ought to be reconceptualized as pluralization. And here again, evangelicals ought to pay a lot of attention, because he says the real challenge of modernity turns out to be not secularization, but pluralization. And that is the reality of rival truth claims. And thus he suggests that the real danger to religious faith is what he calls cognitive contamination. And by this he means the fact that worldviews begin to bleed over into each other, and so that the distinctive integrity of one worldview is surrendered in terms of a form of inevitable syncretism through cognitive contamination. Cognitive contamination, he also said, would lead to persons retreating from the boldness of the cognitive claims they would make. And again, I would suggest this certainly is something that ought to have the attention of evangelicals. Just earlier this year, in February of 2008, in an article published in the journal First Things, Berger simply entitled the article, Secularization Falsified. He said this: ever since the Enlightenment, intellectuals of every stripe have believed that the inevitable consequence of modernity is the decline of religion. The reason was supposed to be the progress of science and its concomitant rationality replacing the irrationality and superstition of religion. Not only Nietzsche, but other seminal modern thinkers thought so, notably Marx, religion as the opiate of the masses, and Freud, religion as illusion. So why did it not happen? He says, because we have learned, and these words are very important, modernity is not, he italicizes the word not, intrinsically secularizing, though it has been so in particular cases. Of course, the two cases he points out are that of Western Europe, and in particularly that of the intellectual elites in the English-speaking world. Again, he says this: simply put, modernity is not characterized by the absence of God, but by the presence of many gods. And of course, that gets down to the pluralization, he says, is a much better understanding of what has actually happened. The third figure, and the most important as we conclude, is Charles Taylor. Canadian, taught at McGill University, All Souls College at Oxford, and is now the Board of Trustees professor at Northwestern University. Charles Taylor's book, The Secular Age, is indeed, I think, the most important work in this entire field of knowledge in many years. And because time has escaped me, let me just suggest that what Charles Taylor is doing is to reconceptualize secularization in terms not of the classical theory as it had been known, but rather in terms of what he calls changed conditions of belief. He sees the secularization theory is in crisis. He says that, you know, the evidence just isn't there. And instead, he suggests that what we now have is the emergence of a world in the West where modernity has produced changed conditions of belief. It is a secular world, he says, in many ways, but it's not a secularized world. And here again, that was an impossible distinction in the mind of the early sociologists, the early formers and framers of the secularization theory. Charles Taylor in A Secular Age argues that we should instead understand that what modernity has produced is a changed set of belief conditions. I think for evangelical theology, for our missiologists, for pastors, for youth ministers, for parents, this is a very, very important understanding. He suggests that if you follow an intellectual progression and history of the Western mind, you would begin with the predominant tradition being an epoch of intellectual frame in which it was not possible not to believe in God. Now, that gets back to the early issues, some functional issues even, of causal explanation. You couldn't not believe in God because there was no other explanation for why anything happened. It was intellectually unsustainable not to believe in God. The word atheist did not appear until the Elizabethan era, because it simply wasn't there. No, there were pagans, but there weren't atheists. Because you had to have some supernatural explanation for why the sun appeared to rise in the morning and why the world held together and everything from earthquakes to the birth of children. Later, early modernity brought what Charles Taylor calls a shift into a second mode in which it was possible not to believe in God. There are now other causal explanations. It is possible to develop a secular mind. It is possible, if one so seeks, to come up with causal explanations and an entire system of meaning in which it is now possible not to believe in God. However, it is possible not to believe in God in such a way that only a very intellectually motivated, intellectual elite will not believe in God. Some of these questions may seep down into the larger body politic, into the larger masses, into the larger population, but you're going to find mostly any assertion that there might not be a God, By the way, Richard Dawkins' latest bus campaign. I wrote about this. You know, the buses in London, they're buying signs that said there probably is no God. Turns out that's not really a very good atheist motto, because an awful lot of people in London are going, wait, you mean there might be? And it turned... needed a better PR agency working on that one. But Charles Taylor argues that this is where almost all the secularization theorists come out of. This is where they're among this elite that decided maybe we don't have to believe in God. Now Charles Taylor says, and this is where it really cuts to us, to evangelical theologians. He says we need to recognize, and this is the whole purpose of his book, we now live in a time in which for many it is now impossible to believe. We've gone from impossible not to believe to possible not to believe to impossible to believe. And one of our challenges is that for vast sectors of the intelligentsia and the intellectual elites, the artistic and culture manufacturing elites, the educational and scientific elites, it is now to them fundamentally impossible to believe. And it is not because they once believed and have surrendered. It is because the intellectual world they inhabit is so thoroughly secularized, not only in terms of causal explanations, but symbolism and linguistic reference and all the rest, that it is to them impossible to believe. Now, I would suggest in conclusion that for evangelicals, this is a grave warning. The secularization theory did fail. It turns out there are exceptions to its failure, the intellectual elites and much of Western Europe. It did fail, but that didn't mean that we are not facing an enormous challenge. I think here Charles Taylor really helps us. The challenge is not a theory outworking as the secularization theorists believe that it would. It's a more fundamental shift in the Western mind, which is becoming more and more a global phenomenon, in which the admissions price into the intellectual elites, the admissions price, the ticket to get into many spheres of academic and cognitive work and knowledge, into many of the intellectual guilds, is to surrender any claim that it might be possible that there might be a God. Very quickly, secularization and its discontents, just a few brief statements. Secularization theory is a theory in crisis. We admit that, we know that. Even those who held it now know it. Two, the ideological framework behind the dominant models of secularization is now more and more evident. We should note that. We should note this was not a value-neutral proposition. It was, as Jeffrey Haddon says, a doctrine promoted by those whose goal was not only to have a theory of secularization prove true in terms of their own academic and intellectual work, but because they were also secularists. Third, secularization theory, so dominant for decades, has now itself become scandalized, and it was, as Jeffrey Haddon said, first sacralized. The people who held it as a matter of absolute faith. You have someone like Gerhard Linsky who said, from its inception, sociology was committed to the positivist view that religion in the modern world is merely a survival from man's primitive past and doomed to disappear as soon as science and general enlightenment should come. It just didn't happen that way. But it's important for us to know that in many areas of, especially the academic guilds, it was taken as a doctrine. Four, secularization theory was for certain cultures, nations, and sectors of these cultures largely predictive, especially Western Europe and the intellectual elites. And this, again, is something we ought to pay a lot of attention to because we work in a field that has been itself increasingly secularized. And an entire work could be done here on looking at adaptation theory and liberal theology. That's basically what it is. It's an adaptation attempt to come to terms with the secular age. By the way, one very fruitful part of this research is that, and you'll find the sociologists now saying this explicitly, it turns out that liberal adaptation theories don't work. Because once you don't need God, you don't need church. It's instead the more conservative, most resistant, most resolutely supernatural forms that have survived and thrived. I think it is important, lastly, that we recognize we are now living and operating, we are witnessing and preaching and teaching, we are operating our seminaries and our schools, we are teaching in our departments within the context of changed conditions of belief, and we ignore these to our peril. We are looking at a generation of young people who've been increasingly shaped by these changed conditions of belief so that they now come to us with presuppositions that are very different than those that we knew when we were at their age. The world of art and culture and symbolism and referent for them has been so changed that it is impossible for many of the people they admire to believe in God, and this shapes their gestalt as well. For evangelicals who are concerned with the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ, for those of us who are concerned with the propagation of the gospel, with the integrity of the church, and with the integrity of evangelical theology, it is Charles Taylor's prophetic word that ought to have our attention at the end. In changed conditions of belief, the issue is how we will respond. The sociologists predict that the response is an adaptation theory. The issue is, what would we adapt and how, without surrendering the soul, not only of the evangelical movement, but of Christianity itself? Thank you.